From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Don't ask, don't tell isn't dead yet. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Pentagon's top brass and civilian leaders asked the Senate today for an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, saying it requires soldiers to lie about their identities. A 10-month study showed more than two-thirds of active-duty troops and their families don't care if gays and lesbians openly serve, but a large percentage of combat soldiers do. Republican John McCain said that called for more study. But Defense Secretary Gates warned of sudden disruption if the courts act before Congress. We'll hear from soldiers with different points of view and look at the prospects in the lame duck session. On Reporter's Notebook later on, big surprises today in world soccer. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The Pew Research Center says 58% of Americans favor repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Pentagon says almost 70% of active duty troops and their families agree. But combat soldiers don't see it that way, and that could mean the 17-year-old member measure stays on the books. On Reporter's Notebook, the U.S. and the U.K. lost big today in international soccer. Future World Cups will go to Russia and Qatar. We'll hear how that happened. First, this news update. President Obama's bipartisan panel on taxes and spending got two more votes today from its own members, with 14 of 18 needed for final approval and another vote scheduled tomorrow. Eric Wasson reports for The Hill newspaper in Washington. Eric, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Oh, hi. Thanks very much for having me.
This is officially the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform, but taxes and spending is what it's really all about. These are two Republicans who said today they would vote for it. Who are they, and what's important about their being Republicans?
Well, it's Tom Coburn from Oklahoma and Mike Crapo from Idaho, and it's very important because the plan contains things that are normally not very well supported by Republicans, such as tax revenue increases by eliminating tax breaks and this is kind of surprising in some ways, especially Coburn, who's often seen as being very partisan in the Senate.
Okay, there are 18 members. How many votes does it have now?
Well, it looks like we got nine votes announced. We could be on track to get 10 because John Spratt, who lost his reelection bid, he's the current chairman of the House Budget Committee. He indicated to me yesterday he probably will go along. So I think we have 10, and there could be more. Some senators are still out there, Senator Durbin, Senator Baucus, and they're playing their cards very close to their chest.
Are all the members of the commission senators?
No, there are senators and House members, as well as some presidential appointees who are not members of Congress. The House Republicans are, in contrast to the Senate Republicans, are coming out pretty strongly against this. I talked to Paul Ryan today. He flat out said he's going to vote no on that, mainly because it doesn't do enough to repeal Obama's health care reform. Representative Jeb Hensarling, also likely a no vote, and David Camp, who's the incoming Ways and Means Committee Chairman, who would be in charge of tax policy, he probably will also vote no.
Why did Tom Coburn and Mike Crapo say they were for it?
Well, they said yesterday that they really want to keep the conversation going. They think it's very important that the nation discuss the deficit. They think that this is something that's going to drive America off the fiscal cliff, cause total deterioration in American society. And they feel that if we get this deficit commission report passed, you know, it could be brought up for a vote in Congress, and that would keep the issue to the forefront. Now, they said plainly that they don't agree with a lot of things in the plan, but they want to keep the conversation going.
Excuse me, it's Coburn and Crapo.
If
they get 14 votes out of the 18, does that automatically mean that it will go to the Congress?
No, not at all. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have said that they would bring it up for a floor vote, but the lame duck session of Congress is really running out of time. They could be in for another couple of weeks, probably going out on December 17th, and this plan is not written like a bill. It's not written in legislative language, so even drafting it into a bill, it just probably won't happen. John Boehner, who's going to come in as the Speaker under the Republican House of Representatives next year, has not made any promise to bring this up for a vote. So even if it got 14 votes and passed the commission under its own bylaws, it's not clear whether it would come to Congress as a bill.
You said that some of these Republicans are concerned that it doesn't do enough to repeal repeal health care reform. They're worried that that's going to drive up health care costs. What are the Democrats worried about who aren't in favor of it?
Well, you know, one of the things that happened when the draft version of this report came out on November 10th was that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called it simply unacceptable. And she was referring to the fact, for example, that Social Security benefits would be cut, especially in the out years. By 2050, this plan would raise the retirement age to 68, would raise it to 69 by 2075. That, you know, touching Social Security or changing Medicare is really anathema to most Democrats. So we have, you know, some liberal members of the panel. Representative Jan Schakowsky came out yesterday and just said she's going to vote against this. She's also concerned, for example, that it makes spending cuts too soon. A lot of these liberals think that there should be more spending in the near term to sort of spend our way out of the current economic downturn and then make cuts later on.
If everything in this measure were to be passed, what would it do to the deficit?
Well, by 2020, it would cut the deficit by about $4 trillion. And the plan contains about 75% of this is achieved through spending cuts and 25% through raising revenue.
So it then wouldn't cut everything. I mean, wouldn't eliminate the deficit by any means.
No. And in fact, under this plan, the debt, which is different than the budget deficits, the overall national debt would be about 40% of gross domestic product by 2035. So we would still have a national debt, but it'd be lower. We're closer to 62% of gross domestic product. The debt is 62% of gross domestic product today.
People are living longer, but even so, the Democrats don't go for raising that retirement age for Social Security benefits.
It's pretty much been a sacred cow for them for a very long time.
Okay. Eric Wasson, again, reports on budget and appropriations for The Hill, a newspaper in Washington, D.C. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thanks very much for having me.
In a moment, Don't Ask, Don't Tell isn't dead yet on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren Alney back with To the Point. Admiral Mike Mullen, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, made a personal appeal to the Senate Armed Services Committee today to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
I've been serving with gays and lesbians my whole career. I went to war with them aboard a destroyer off the coast of Vietnam. I knew they were there. They knew I knew it. And what's more, nearly everyone in the crew knew it. We never missed a mission, never failed to deliver ordnance on target. Readiness was not impaired. What mattered most, what made us a crew, was teamwork and focus on our combat mission.
Again, that was Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. A Pentagon survey of 115,000 active duty troops and their families showed that two-thirds would not object to open service by gays and lesbians. Defense Secretary Gates conceded, though, that it also showed 58% of combat troops did have a problem. And that set up an exchange between him and Arizona Republican John McCain.
Most of the Marines who are in combat are 18 to 24, 25 years old. Most of them have never served with women either. And so they've had a very focused, very limited experience in the military, and it's been a tough one. But I think that with time and adequate preparation, we can mitigate their concerns.
Well, I couldn't disagree more. We send these young people into combat. We think they're mature enough to fight and die. I think they're mature enough to make a judgment on who they want to serve with and the impact on their battle effectiveness. Mr. Secretary, I speak from personal experience.
John McCain, of course, shot down and captured and held for a long time during the Vietnam War. Gordon Lubold is a defense reporter for Politico. He's covering the hearing. Good to have you with us.
How are you, Warren?
Very well, thank you. What else went on today?
Well, it was an interesting hearing. This is the first of two. Today was with Gates and Mullen, as you point out, and then the two co-authors of the study. And then tomorrow, more kind of fireworks expected, really, because the chiefs of each service testify. And this will be the first time where they publicly All of them will give their potentially candid views about repeal. You know, the thing that was just interesting today was this this discussion about whether troops should be asked specifically whether they think repeal should happen or not. This survey, which, you know, a lot of lawmakers there today and others have said, you know, is one of the most comprehensive studies ever done, left out one question that opponents of repeal really think should have been included, and that is, what do you think should be done? Do you think the law should be repealed or not? All the other data was kind of asked the question in a roundabout way. But this kind of generated this discussion, which is kind of an interesting issue, is, you know, how far do you go in asking troops and polling troops what they really think? And Gates and Mullen said, look, we don't poll them about invading Iraq. We don't poll them about 15-month tours. Why should we do that now? It sets a bad precedent.
How did McCain respond to that?
Well, McCain, you know, this is his one thing. Now, McCain had said he would reserve judgment on this issue until he saw the results of this study. And now this is kind of the main thing that he is criticizing this study for. He thinks that you can't, you know, essentially force a major shift on the military without polling the people who are most affected. What I think is where the rub is that, you know, the stuff that they the numbers McCain have relied on to that show that more combat forces are opposed to this seem to be, you know, legitimate numbers in their minds, but they think that the numbers showing support, the 70% or so, isn't necessarily legitimate because it doesn't ask that question.
Again, though, Gates very strongly argued that what soldiers do is take orders. You don't ask them what they're supposed to do, and he seems to be worried about the precedent.
Well, Secretary Gates has concerns about this issue, and honestly, he has not been as emphatic as Admiral Mullen has about repealing this thing. In recent days, he's been making the argument that either Congress does this or the courts will, and if the courts do it, it could be ugly. It could be not a good thing for the force. You know, I think that Gates feels strongly that if the proper training and leadership is used, these problems will be mitigated. He said that repeatedly today. One interesting thing about the combat issue, you know, again, higher numbers oppose it if they serve in combat roles. But in the context of intense combat, respondents in the survey said that their concerns about whether they were serving alongside a gay or lesbian service member started to decrease. So there's kind of like a lot of mixed messages in the results, but we'll see. Tomorrow will be an interesting day.
And the reason that Gates is saying that it might be ugly if the courts made the decision would be, I take it, that it would then be something that would have to be implemented right away. They wouldn't have time to train and prepare?
Exactly. You'd essentially be flipping a switch. And all this process that Gates and others have kind of tried to build into this process, the one that they're trying to follow now, you know, accounts for this training to make sure, you know, that everything's set. Gates and Mullen then have to certify that the force is then ready. And he has not, pointedly, not said how long that process would take. So that is, if Congress did repeal the law, the policy, Gates has said, we'll need some time, and I'm not going to be, you know, kind of penned into a certain time frame. But he knows that Obama really wants to get it done.
And back to the courts, there are any number of suits, and I take it people have said there may be more. There's some now pending before the courts as we speak.
Well, one of the Republican lawmakers made a point earlier today that it feels like the two branches of government are hemming in the third, and that is that the executive and the judicial branch really are kind of forcing the hand of Congress to make something happen here. You know, it's not clear how it will play out yet. proponents really feel like they have the votes to make this happen, but it'll take another couple weeks to get through these hearings and discussions before we'll know if it works or not.
And Gates, of course, has taken the position that it is inevitable that Don't Ask, Don't Tell will go by the boards.
Right, and he wants to be able to do it right.
Gordon Lubold, again, defense reporter for Politico. Matt Gallagher is a former Army captain, served a 15-month deployment in Iraq. He's the author of Kaboom, Embracing the Suck in a Savage Little War. Matt Gallagher, Captain Gallagher, thanks a lot for being on our program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
You're against this.
No, I'm for the repeal, actually.
You're for the repeal?
Yes, I am.
Totally apologize to you. Tell us why.
I served 15 months during the surge as a scout platoon leader, and it is a very hyper macho culture. But one thing is dominant there, and will earn respect there, and that's competency, and it has nothing to do with somebody's sexuality. Will the repeal end up bringing some local leadership challenges? Absolutely. There won't be a rush of gay people all of a sudden joining the military. They've already been serving there. So a lot of these concerns that Senator McCain and the Marine Commandant have brought up really to me seem very outdated.
We heard Admiral Mullen say that he served alongside gay people during the Vietnam War and there was no problem. Did you?
I didn't know anybody that was totally out. Everybody, of course, has their suspicions, much like Admiral Mullen references, and you just go about your business. And if a soldier proved himself capable, we're 9 years into these wars. There are bigger problems at hand. You know, you're dealing with life and death on an everyday basis. A lot of that goes out the window. So kicking completely capable people out of the military right now when less than 1% of the American population is serving just seems backwards to me.
Matt Gallagher, again, a former Army captain, in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Kieran Lawler is a former Marine. He served in the Iraq War. He's the founder of Iraq Vets for Congress, also author of the book This Recruit. In 2008, he was a Republican candidate for New York's 19th congressional district seat. Welcome back to our program. Kieran Lawler, good to have you with us.
Great to be back.
You're not in favor of a repeal. Respond, if you will, to what we just heard from Matt Gallagher and to what Admiral Mullen had to say today.
Sure. Specific to what Admiral Mullen said, he said he served with people that they thought were gay. They didn't mention that they were gay, and they accomplished a mission. That is almost an endorsement of the current Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He's saying a policy where there might be homosexuals serving, but they are not out works. Which is exactly the current policy. So that really wasn't an endorsement of repeal, if you dissect what he said. I think the biggest question that wasn't asked is, does repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell help our troops accomplish the mission? The whole study says it is a low risk that it will hurt our ability to accomplish our missions. I think that is a very low bar. I think the bar is, do we do this, and does it help us to accomplish the missions? Look at the effort that has gone into this. I read the whole study. 49 military officers spent 10 months working on this, 19 full-time civilians, countless amounts of dollars. At a time when we have ID deaths going through the roof and no solution shortly down the road to that scourge, we have a massive situation where intelligence has been leaked and publicized around the world and done untold damage. Veterans care is not up to par. So why are we committing so many resources to something that no one even argues will help us accomplish our military missions? That's my question. That's the question that needed to be asked.
Let me go first back to Gordon Lubold with Politico. Was that issue raised today at the Senate Armed Services Commission, that nobody asked whether this will help?
Well, I mean, the question did come is this really the right time? Which is kind of the obvious question. 10 years of war, we're in kind of one and a half wars now, 150,000 troops deployed. Why do it now? And Gates had what I thought was kind of an interesting answer, just because he hadn't answered the question that way before, which was, if not now, then when? And he said, look, the world is not going to become necessarily a safer place anytime soon. So for people who say, like General Senator McCain, hey, this can happen, we can do this later, let's just take our time, Gates' answer is, no, we can't, because, he's got the judicial concerns about the courts, but also the life is not going to let up anytime soon for the military, and it's not going to be any less stressful of a time to do it later on.
Matt Gallagher, our former captain, who is in favor of repeal, what about this question of whether or not it would help the combat mission, should that in fact be asked?
It should be asked, and of course it would help the combat mission, because currently we're kicking out otherwise completely capable soldiers, NCOs, and officers because of this policy. So if you lose just one or two of those people, of course it's hurting the combat mission. And this is happening across the board.
What's your evidence for that? How do you know that competent people are in fact leaving the service because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because they get outed?
Well, personal experience. Also, you know, they're the prominent ones. Lieutenant Dan Chow, I believe is his name, Arabic translator, graduate of West Point, was kicked out of this policy. Another man named Captain Jonathan Hopkins, I believe, was eventually outed, and he had quite a combat quite a lot of combat experience. And these are just the ones that are coming up. What about the people that are getting out of the military or not even joining because this policy is currently in place? This is the 21st century. Somebody's sexuality, you know, they can be open in the rest of society. That should transcend over to their profession as well.
Listening to this conversation, ready to participate, is Jonathan Hopkins, again, former Army captain, deployed 3 times to Iraq and Afghanistan, recipient of 3 Bronze Stars, honorably discharged in August under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. He's now a spokesperson for the advocacy group OutServe. Jonathan Hopkins, Captain Hopkins, thank you very much for being on our program.
Good afternoon, Warren.
We only have a brief moment before we go to a break, so let me just ask you to respond first, if you will, as briefly as possible to that question. Would it help if Don't Ask, Don't Tell were eliminated? Would it, in fact, help the combat mission of the military services?
I think there's a parallel to a question Gates was asked today about whether integration of women and desegregation of the military, although turbulent at the time that it happened, whether our military is now better for it. They asked Gates that, and without hesitation, he said yes. I know from my own personal experience as a company commander, my job was to lead 170 troops, prepare them for combat. But I had to spend a part of every day going through my mind trying to make sure nobody thought I was gay, nobody was questioning whether I was gay or anything else like that. Not because being gay was so bad. It was just because, you know, I was scared every day that I'd get kicked out of the service. It doesn't help, kind of as Matt was saying, it doesn't help with our concentration on getting the job done. And furthermore, with the idea that, with the whole question, is kind of, it's rather a high bar to say we should only change the policy if it helps the military. One, I'd say it does. But two, the whole idea that you're going to discriminate against a group, whether even for no good reason, is probably not the best one.
Okay. Again, former Captain Jonathan Hopkins. We'll come back and continue this conversation. Thanks a lot to Gordon Lubold with Politico for being with us so far. On Reporter's Notebook, big surprise today in world soccer. Back in a moment with To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, being heard today before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Secretary Gates, Chief of Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen testifying along with the co-authors of the study that the Pentagon has done, finding that most on-duty people don't care about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, whereas there is a difference in the number of people who are involved in combat. And in that context, Kieran Lawler, former Marine who was opposed to repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, raised this question. Should the question be asked of people in the service whether it would help to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? Jonathan Hopkins, who was honorably discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, said yes, it would, and said that he, as a company commander, was distracted from his duties, couldn't concentrate in the way that he had to because he had to worry about whether or not it would be revealed that he was gay. Kieran Lawler, back to you, former Marine. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, we have a 2.5 million person military, and over the 17 years of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, about 800 people per year have been discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That's, you know, a fraction of a fraction of a fraction. A lot of those discharges, if you look at the actual cases, are somebody committed some kind of sexual assault. They were charged with that. And in the investigation, it was determined that they were homosexual, and they were then discharged. So it's not just purely we found out. Of those very few, 800 a year, we found out that you're a homosexual, therefore you're kicked out. Oftentimes there are other circumstances, other actual crimes that have been committed.
I understand. You know, well, excuse me, before you go on, it's my understanding that the number of people who have been cashiered for sexual assault are by far in the majority heterosexuals rather than homosexuals.
Well, if you consider that the average or the United States, about 3% of the population are homosexuals, according to the Pentagon's own statistics, about 8% of the sexual assaults in the military are homosexual in nature. So that those statistics say that a homosexual in the military is almost three times more likely to commit a sexual assault against one of his comrades. Those are the Pentagon statistics there. If you don't like those statistics, maybe you can look at the methodologies. But I think it's negligence, maybe gross negligence on the part of the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to call for repeal without investigating their own statistics that were reported in the New York Times earlier this year.
Okay, I want to get back to the question of distraction from duty. But Jonathan Hopkins, first, let me ask you, respond to what we just heard from Kieran Lawler.
Well, you know, I think the soldiers, sailors, and airmen, Marines, you probably have the best view to figure out whether their unit will do better when they know a buddy is gay or not. It's probably those people who have served in units where they didn't know anybody was gay and where they did know somebody was gay. If you look at the statistics, and speaking of investigating the statistics, of those soldiers that know of somebody in their unit who's gay, 92% of them, this is almost unanimous, say there's no negative impact. That really just evidences that kind of what Kieran's pointing to, stereotypes. Stereotypes causing fear as opposed to the facts on the ground. And that's probably about the most important statistic you can look to. What's noteworthy is our country and tons of other countries had these big, large debates and people claiming they're going to leave the force. But in no place, no country that has ever done this, has there been a reduction in retention or enlistment or anything else like that. The force remains strong, cohesive, and you eliminated the sense of a house divided against itself. It's not based on competence and character, because those are the only two things that matter.
Kieran Lawler, it's well known that there are many gay people in and lesbian people in the service. We heard Admiral Mullen say he served with many. Everybody knew it, and they got along fine. Jonathan Hopkins, though, says that he did have a problem because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which wasn't in effect when Admiral Mullen was on the ship off of Vietnam. So, again, what about this issue that gays and lesbians who are in the service can't perform their duties as well because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
I think what Captain Hopkins is saying is he had something weighing on his mind from his personal life, and it made it more difficult to do his job, which is that is the nature of life. I mean, everybody has issues in their personal life, and then they go and they do their job. It might impact them negatively, but it is the professional's duty to make sure that it doesn't impact their job negatively. So, you have something going on in your personal life, and you have to deal with it. That doesn't seem like an argument in favor of changing a policy without any evidence that it will improve the organization, in this case, the military. The Department of Defense commissioned this study. The study comes back and it says almost a supermajority of combat veterans oppose repeal. And then the Secretary of Defense essentially said today, in a clip you played on this show, oh, those silly guys have been fighting a war their whole time in the military. What do they know about the military? It's in essence what the Secretary of Defense said. Why did they commission the study? Why did they break it down by combat troops, find out that an overwhelming majority of combat troops, the actual war fighters, don't like the policy, and then say, we still think the policy should be repealed?
Let me go back to Matt Gallagher, our former Army captain, again, who served 15 months in Iraq and was in combat there. How do you respond to what Kieran Lawler just brought up?
Well, first, I want to go back to the sexual assault statistics. I mean, that's just complete red herring. It's not really relevant at all to what we're discussing, which is the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Second, with regards to what Captain Hopkins was saying and personal life impacting his professional life, you know, we've all been downrange. That, of course, personal concerns bleed into a professional life, but if he's unable to share that with other people because they don't ask, don't want to tell, that's an unfair burden, you know, as opposed to somebody who's straight, who's dealing with personal concerns. Going back to your original question to me with regards to the combat troops and their opinion, yeah, their opinion matters, but I don't think it should be the prominent one. You know, as Admiral Mullen and Secretary Gates said, they didn't poll the combat troops ahead of time before the Iraq or Afghanistan invasion. Part of being in the military is signing on that dotted line and doing what you're supposed to do. And I have no doubt that when this repeal goes through, that all the military, both the combat troops and otherwise, will be able to adapt and overcome.
Captain Gallagher, what does it take to get into combat, to put yourself into that position? What kind of person does it require to go through basic training and actually get out there on the front lines?
Yeah, it takes a very motivated, competent individual. You know, it's kind of complete opposite of stereotypes of, you know, joining the infantry because you have no place else to go. This modern, all-volunteer professional force, it's the cream of the crop. You know, it's not going to be just a bunch of queens all of a sudden rushing to join the infantry after this repeal goes through. It's going to be a very motivated, competent individual, straight or gay. And if a gay soldier proves himself worthy of getting there, you know, his other soldiers are going to respect it. It still may be a personal concern for some of them, but the time of it being a professional issue is far gone.
Kieran Lawler, again, back to you, our former Marine. What about that? If you can get through the training, which is pretty rough in the Marine Corps, and actually qualify to be in a combat, then don't you have a right to serve?
No, I don't think you do. I mean, people get discharged for a number of different reasons. People are denied entrance into the service because of age and a number of other factors. The U.S. military is not deemed to be a reflection of society. There is inherent discriminations in the military. So, a lot of people who are not allowed to serve in the military could get through basic training. There are 60-year-olds who do triathlons who would not be allowed to go through basic training because it is determined that, on the whole, that's not what is best for the military.
What about the issue of discrimination raised by Captain Hopkins? In what ways does this compare or not compare with having African Americans and women in the military? Kieran Lawler.
I think the African American analogy is often cited, but it's a bad analogy. Think about it. We have African Americans being drafted into the U.S. military and then being told, you're in separate units. That's very different, conscription and then segregation. That is morally offensive, but I think in the military context, it's economically and militarily offensive. For example, the Marine Corps had Paris Island for white recruits, and then in North Carolina, a whole separate facility for black recruits. That didn't make economic sense, it didn't make military sense, and it was a good decision to get rid of segregation in the military, and the country followed.
What about women?
Women aren't totally integrated into the military. Women are not in the infantry. And I think the infantry is the key military occupational specialty that should be discussed here because it makes up only 4% of the military, but 81% of those killed in action are infantry. I would have loved to have seen a poll of infantrymen. If the average combat arms veteran in, said, 60% or so of them are against repeal, I would think the infantrymen would be even higher because that's where you have the most intimate living conditions and the most unit cohesion issues.
Let me get a final word from Jonathan Hopkins, again, a former Army captain, deployed 3 times to Iraq and Afghanistan, recipient of 3 stars, then honorably discharged in August because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What about the fact that women are not allowed in a combat? How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't think that's – I think the more prescient point that Kieran just brought up is I can speak directly to. I am an infantry officer, where I was until August. I had two infantry companies. I think Kieran, before he makes some of his statements, should just reassess as a Marine what his core values are. As I understand them, they're honor, courage, and commitment. But he's saying that under this rule, people should have to betray their honor to stay in the force. I talked about the challenges I had. I could not be honest. It wasn't just a passive thing. People would ask, you know, where's your wife? Aren't you married? You have to create stories to do that. So basically this rule is a paradox. And Kieran is asking that we make certain Marines, certain Army people, certain sailors to be dishonorable, to have a lack of integrity. That is not living up to our core values. It does not cause us to lead people better. And, you know, I had infantry troops, all infantry troops. And after they found out I was gay, I got tons of notes from them saying, well, we all figured you were gay and we didn't care because you were the best commander we've ever had. And this is not just one or two people. This is dozens upon dozens. They even knew friends that, you know, they didn't have a good feel about the gay thing, but they loved that I was a good commander. And that is reflected in the study. Kieran wants to see numbers about combat troops, about infantrymen. They are there. 85% of Marines in combat units who know somebody who's gay say, hey, this causes no problem. They've seen it. 89% of Army soldiers who are infantrymen and tankers who know somebody who is gay, they have no problem with it. The challenge here is merely stereotypes drummed up by people like Kieran. Everyone is better off when you allow competent people to serve. The gay people who don't get discriminated against, don't get told to lie, and put in a state of fear are better off, as well as the straight people who are no longer basing their judgment on stereotypes, but are basing it on the same things we've always based our judgments of military leadership and performance on, just your competence and your character, your ability to do the job. If infantrymen who are gay or anybody else who's gay can't do the job in undermining unit cohesion, they should get booted out of the unit or barred from reenlistment or get poor performance reviews based upon that fact alone, not upon any other unrelated component of their character. Reassess your core values. They will lead you the way. The core values of the Marine Corps tell exactly what way to go. Tell the truth, let people serve, and be committed to the military and do their job.
Former Army Captain Jonathan Hopkins, three Bronze Stars, cashiered, or I shouldn't say cashiered, he was honorably discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Kieran Lawler, you're outnumbered on this program. Very quickly, your response to that.
Yeah, I'll go back to my original point. If we are concerned about the U.S. military, we should only be investing resources into reforms that will improve it. And no one is making the argument. Now, this study, other than anecdotal information on this particular interview, no one is making the argument that widespread open homosexuals in the military will improve the U.S. military. You know, why would we want to implement this policy that we are not sure it's going to work, even the study says it's low risk, on all five branches? Why not try it out on one branch? I think the reason we would never see it tried out on one branch, and the branches all have different standards in other aspects, the reason we don't see it tried out on one branch is that branch would lose recruitment, and the other branches would shoot up. And I think that is a big mistake to do it DOD-wide repeal, not knowing what the results will be. When the supporters of repeal even say there's low risk. So there is a risk, and nobody is arguing that there is a reward. And I think that is the most important thing. I'm concerned about improving the military, and I would like to put resources into improving the military, not okay. Reforms that may or may not help.
All right. Kieran Lawler, former Marine, served in Iraq, founder of Iraq That's for Congress, a former candidate for Congress in New York, author of the book This Recruit. Thanks to you. And thanks also to Matt Gallagher, our former Army captain, served a 15-month deployment in Iraq. He is in favor, as is Jonathan Hopkins, of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Dan Friedman is a staff writer at the National Journal. He covers Senate leadership there. Dan Friedman, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What are the prospects now, particularly given the throwing down of the glove by the Republicans yesterday on working out the Bush tax cuts? What are the chances of Don't Ask, Don't Tell actually being voted on? Where is it in terms of the legislative process, and what prospects does it have?
I,
I'd say the chances are murky, but it's going to be difficult. There's at least three obstacles, as you mentioned. The Republicans threaten to filibuster everything, including the defense authorization bill, which includes the Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal, until they get a deal on taxes and on extending the federal budget. Secondly, the part of that, if there is a deal, it sounds like it may be to get the START treaty on the floor of the Senate and get a vote on it. Republicans currently say they want 2 weeks to debate that. They probably won't get that, but if they get even a week, that's going to make it tough for there to be time to do the defense authorization bill on the floor, because that also is going to take up a bunch of time in order for Democrats to be able to pass it. And then the third obstacle is that Democrats still have to get the votes to make sure that they can pass it. Things are not maybe quite as difficult as that sounds, though, because despite the Republican threat, it's not exactly clear how much that applies to the defense authorization bill and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Susan Collins, the senator from Maine, who Democrats are hoping will vote for that, has said that even though she signed that Republican letter, that she might still vote for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell if Senate Majority Leader Reid allows an open amendment process. So it's a pretty – everything is kind of linked together, and it's a pretty murky picture right now.
If Susan Collins were to go for it, a Republican from Maine, would that give them the 60 votes they need?
No, they right now there's 42 Senate Republicans. And it's not clear they're going to get all the Democrats. So they need to get at least a few Republicans on the bill.
If, in fact, they don't pass the defense authorization bill, what happens?
That's a good question. The Congress has passed a defense authorization bill every year since they began doing defense authorization bills. Yet many other federal agencies, for example, the Department of Homeland Security, continues to function every year without passage of a bill which authorizes many of their policies. There are a lot of specific provisions in the defense authorization bill that are what they call must-pass. There's some stuff that has to do with authorizing salary increases for some members of the military. The Armed Services Committee don't like to talk about it because they want the defense authorization bill to pass, but they do have contingency plans for passing some of the must-pass pieces of the defense authorization bill, but certainly the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell is not one of those.
So they could pull various provisions out and vote on them separately and then not vote on the whole bill because it has the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in it?
Yes, they could do that. Certainly the House Armed Services Committee has at least talked about what would be in that kind of bill, but they don't want to sort of give up their negotiating leverage by talking about that. They want to insist that they still want the entire package passed.
We have the chiefs of all of the services, military services, coming to testify before the committee tomorrow, the Armed Services Committee. Certainly the Commandant of the Marine Corps is going to say he wants to keep Don't Ask, Don't Tell. How much more time is the Senate going to devote to this?
It's not clear. They can talk about it in committee. You know, they're probably going to be here until at least December 18th, maybe into the following week. So that, you know, they can have plenty of committee hearings. The issue is how much floor time is going to be available. And as I mentioned, the challenge is that Susan Collins and the other Republicans, Richard Lugar from Indiana is one, who Democrats are hoping will vote for this, have said they need to have an open amendment process for the bill, for them to vote for the bill. And that means at least a week. Last year it took about a week to pass. So, you know, when you're talking about doing taxes, you're talking about extending the federal budget, you're talking about doing the START treaty, there's just not enough time for all those things.
Okay, and the one thing we haven't mentioned is the DREAM Act. That also is something the Democrats want to see, Harry Reid particularly.
Yeah, there's a couple other bills, so it's quite confusing, and something's going to have to fall.
Okay, Dan Friedman, staff writer of the National Journal, covers the Senate leadership and much of the rest of the Congress as well. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
The U.S. and Britain today got kicked in the shins by Russia and Qatar, who were awarded the world's largest sporting event for 2018 and 2022. We'll have more on the future of the World Cup in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warman Alney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. In Zurich yesterday, Britain's presentation was made by soccer star David Beckham, Prime Minister David Cameron, and Prince William. The U.S. was represented by Bill Clinton and Morgan Freeman. But today, the president of FIFA, World Soccer's governing body, said, "We go to new lands, namely Eastern Europe and the Middle East." Jeri Longman is author of The Girls of Summer. That's a book about the United States soccer team that won the 1999 Women's World Cup. He was in Zurich today for the New York Times. Good to have you on our program.
Good to be here, but I must say I'm not in Zurich. I'm in the States.
You're not in Zurich. Okay. Well, I transported you, and you zipped on back. Teleportation, I guess we could
I'm in the great Swiss city of Philadelphia right now.
Okay. Well, you nonetheless know what went on in Zurich, and the question is, why Russia? Why Qatar?
Well, the most benign explanation is that FIFA has a kind of Star Trek quality about it, that it wants to go where no man or at least no sports administrators have gone before. So, you know, because the World Cup was a great success this past summer in South Africa, I think FIFA officials were emboldened that they could, that they ought to continue to take the World Cup to places that have never hosted it. So you've got two emerging economies, Russia and Qatar, which, you know, may be the fastest growing economy in the world. And I think that Joseph Sepp Blatter, who's the Swiss head of FIFA, you know, wants to continue to bring the World Cup to, you know, to new state. It's the biggest game to the biggest and the biggest stages to places that have not hosted it before.
Remind our listeners where Qatar is.
It's in the Middle East. So it's, you know, an oil and gas-rich nation of 1.7 million people, the smallest country to host the World Cup. But, you know, money will be no object there. And the biggest concern there was that it, you know, the tournament is held in June and July when it temperatures can reach 120 degrees Fahrenheit there. So they've said they're going to build air-conditioned stadiums, you know, and cool it to 80-something degrees, which will still be hot, but not 120 degrees. And they have to build a lot of stadiums, nine new stadiums, but they're going to connect them all by a rail system, so that apparently that was appealing. And afterward, they plan to dismantle their stadiums and give them to poorer countries, which also was appealing to FIFA.
Money might not be an object in some respects. In others, it is alleged that it probably was. There are those who say that Russia, which is also an oil-rich country, and Qatar both, had a lot on the table.
Yeah, you know, FIFA is frequently criticized for its lack of transparency. I mean, it's a closed, insular organization, unregulated by any other organization, frequently hit with charges of corruption. So it's really, and these votes were done in secret in Zurich, so it's impossible to know, you know, exactly what the motives were. I mean, before the before Thursday's votes, there were a series of embarrassing news media revelations in Europe saying that you know, that some of the FIFA executives who were voting had been willing to trade their votes. Two of them were banned from voting today. There were also accusations that Qatar had attempted to trade votes with the joint bid from Spain and Portugal, which was bidding on the 2018 World Cup in an attempt to sort of enhance both candidacies. So, you know, some people some people also suggested that they ought to delay these votes, that the legitimacy of today's votes could not be guaranteed given the charges of corruption. But FIFA ignored those calls, and so you know, we have to sort of settle with these votes without really knowing precisely why they occurred.
Has a team from Qatar ever qualified to play in the World Cup?
No, but, you know, Saudi Arabia, there are Middle East teams who have qualified. As a matter of fact, there's never been a major, there's horse racing in Qatar, but there's never been a major international event like this in the Middle East. Previously, Qatar's actually one of its major claims to sort of visibility in world sports has been to offer nationalization to Kenyan distance runners who come and compete for Qatar and take a different name and, you know, win medals.
The 1994 World Cup was played in the United States. More people attended that one than have ever attended any other, and yet soccer didn't really catch on in the United States in the way it has, at least in much of the world, certainly more popular than it was before. Is that something that mitigated against choosing the United States?
Again, you know, it's impossible to know exactly, but that's one theory, is that, you know, FIFA said, well, we've already done a lot for the States by giving you the 1994 World Cup. Some people believe that even though President Obama and former President Clinton or behind the bid, that the United States promoted the sort of the financial aspects of it, you know, record attendance, record sponsorships, record TV rights, and did not have the sufficient passion for saying how this would continue to grow the game in the United States. But it's, you know, again, it's impossible to know exactly, but that's one theory.
Hard to know if it'll grow the game in Qatar with 1.7 million people, especially if they're going to give away the soccer stadiums after it's over.
Well, some people believe that Sepp Blatter, the head of FIFA, that what he's really angling for is the Nobel Peace Prize, and having brought the World Cup to South Africa, then to Russia, then to Qatar, then maybe that would enhance his candidacy. You know, that's the talk that's out there. It's hard to know precisely. I mean, presumably he does have some genuine interest in exporting his game, you know, around the globe.
Okay, so it's Russia in 2018 and Qatar in 2022. Is that right?
That's right.
Jerry Longman, again, the sports reporter for the New York Times, author of The Girls of Summer, about the United States soccer team that won the 1999 Women's World Cup. Really good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Wherever you are.
Take care.
Today's program produced by Katie Cooper with Carolyn Radziner and Gary Scott, technical director Mike Newport. Email us, share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/To The Point, and check out To The Point on Facebook. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.